So there, those kinds of reality checks, it can be very powerful, and they may not hold in court. I mean, that's not what this process is really ultimately about. It's about the person reclaiming self. And that having that kind of external validation, I think, can be extraordinarily helpful in the process.
Do you think there might be possible pitfalls or dangers of the therapist in helping their clients get that corroborative evidence?
Well, it shouldn't be for evidence. A therapist is not a lawyer. A therapist is not... The job is not to go out and... is to help the person form a legal case. Okay? The therapist's job, though, is to help the person do what he or she needs to do to heal. And I think it is very important to do reality checks.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe reality check is a better way of talking about it. It's than sort of getting evidence. It's just it's basically looking at, okay, is this explicit way that I'm interpreting my implicit memory, does it have some accuracy to it? Yeah. I think that's helpful.
Right. So you've mentioned that the False Memory Foundation. Well, I'll ask you, how do you feel that they have affected resources for survivors of sexual or ritual abuse or mind control?
I think that in terms, as I was saying a little bit before, is that in terms of access to therapy and as in terms of access to groups that are dealing with this kind of materials, in terms of funding, that the False Memory Foundation has really, really impaired access to these kinds of resources. Certainly in terms of books, in terms of discussion groups, in terms of the internet, I don't think there's an impairment at all. I think in some ways it's brought a lot of people together to try to advocate against the False Memory Foundation and what they're saying. So in that way, I think that it's helped that, it's helped groups of people get together and talk. But I do think it's also what the False Memory Foundation says can be very harmful to people who are at the beginning or in the midst of their processes. That there's this cultural denial that the False Memory Foundation is feeding, and it has an impact on a very personal level. You know, families use this against you if there's been some sort of confrontation. Families use it in their arguments against the survivor who's talking. And I think that that the kinds of strategies that the False Memory Foundation is encouraging are extremely intrusive and violating. And as Judith Herman said at the recent International Society for Study of Dissociation conference, it's a mouthful, they're using the same kind of intimidation tactics, that perpetrators have used in the abuse, there's a lot of perpetrator rage there, and that the False Memory Foundation is really harboring a lot of perpetrators. Mm-hmm. Maybe not every single person who belongs to the False Memory Foundation is a perpetrator, but there are a lot of people who do belong, who I believe have perpetrated and are using this as basically a front.
Yeah, and certainly there has been documented evidence of the members of the advisory board being involved in CIA mind control.
That's right.
And being active pedophiles and so forth. Now, and of course, one of the arguments that they're repeatedly used is that therapists have been implanting false memories in their clients. But do you feel that it's possible that people may have false memories I'll say false memories of sexual abuse?
Well, let's go back a minute. Let's talk about false memory. Because I think a lot of people have false memories. I think most of us have some false memories. And in fact, the way false memories often go is that we tend to idealize people. We tend to idealize our families and what happened in our families. We tend to not remember uncomfortable events vividly. We might change them. We might think that we had a wonderful family when in fact we had a family that argued all the time. Or, you know, those are the kinds of things that people tend to block out. And there's research that really backs that up, that shows that, you know, when there's been documented abuse or abusive situations, that it's with a group of boys that were basically interviewed many years later, that they tended to minimize the abuse rather than remember exactly how horrific it was. So people have false memories that idealize and minimize. Okay.
Just saying the tendency more is that way in terms of exaggerating the negative aspects.
Well,
it
makes sense. I mean, if I've been talking about homeostasis. Yeah. We try to find the things that are going to make us feel better. So we tend to try to think that people are nicer than they are, or situations are safer than they really are, to try to bring down our anxiety levels or try to make ourselves feel better. And it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense to me. Now, in terms of false memories in therapy, I've really had to look at that and realize that, of course, that can happen. That, you know, as I say, people are interpreting their experiences in these ways that are inaccurate, that can be quite inaccurate. Explicit memory, we can remember something that happened yesterday in an inaccurate way. If it doesn't, this also has to do with our adrenaline level. If an experience happens and we don't particularly pay attention to it, our adrenaline level is pretty low. We don't remember all the details. We also filter out. We have something in our brains called a reticular formation, which helps to filter out experience. Because if we weren't filtering out and we were paying attention to our tastes and the smells and the sounds and our emotions and all things at once, we would be overwhelmed all the time. Our nervous systems wouldn't be able to handle it. So filtering is a really important part of how we remember, we experience things, and how we remember our experiences. So if we are in a particular circumstance one day that we're trying to recall the next day, and our adrenaline level wasn't particularly high because it wasn't a particularly significant moment in our lives, we may not remember things very accurately. If it's much more significant to us, our adrenaline level will be higher. This is a theory. And that the adrenaline level really affects how we remember things. That if then something was really emotionally significant to us, and we may remember certain aspects of things, while someone else that was involved in that same experience may remember totally different aspects. Other things may have been significant to that other person. So we may remember, let's say that we have the visual things were very important to, let's say, to me. And let's say that the other person was really tuned into the sounds. And let's say I'm asked a question about the sounds. I may be really inaccurate about the sounds, and I may guess at things to try to answer the question for the other person. And let's say the other person was asked about visual. And the same thing may be happening for him or her. And so they may be very accurate on the sounds and very inaccurate on the visual. And so what happens is that there are aspects then of each person's experience that might be more accurate and less accurate about a particular event. Okay, let's take this into therapy. That we do tend, I mean, I think the research is very clear that we do tend to fill in gaps. We do tend to try to explain things that are making us uncomfortable and that we might not have an explanation for. And good therapy will help the person to remain in uncertainty in those areas where there is uncertainty. And to encourage the person not to do that that very natural process, not to exaggerate it, not to, you know, that if it becomes very clear what are the major areas of concentration for somebody, whether somebody is a visual person or an auditory person or an olfactory person, you know, what are the senses that are most important for that person? How do they remember experience? How do they live their lives? And so that what I think is very distressing to people, but they need to learn to do in this whole process, is if they have a fragment of a memory here and another one there and another one there, is not to force them all together in a way that they don't fit. And it's a very complex, difficult, layered process, and it's very important, though, when things do fit, to look at the correlations, but to also look at this may or may not be the way that it was.
So how does a group like the False Memory Syndrome Foundation use the nature of inaccurate memories? And
okay, well,
how do they use that against survivors that have had legitimate histories of sexual abuse?
Okay, well, I think what they do, it's not just using inaccurate memories, but what they do is they take research about one kind of memory and they apply it to traumatic memory. So they take research about ordinary, everyday, explicit memory. And they apply it, they act as if all memory operates in the same way that ordinary everyday memory would operate. So they really, I mean, now they're being a bit less extreme. They're acknowledging that dissociation does occur. But and it's not just one person. There are different people speaking out for the organization, so different people have different takes. I mean, you know, the whole argument about is there such a thing as repressed memory? One of the people that is very active in the False Memory Foundation and whose research has been used and I think misused by the False Memory Foundation is Elizabeth Loftus. Now, her studies are not done on traumatized people. And she has argued against the existence of repressed memory. And yet, in a study she did with a number of other colleagues, even though it was maybe a smaller sample that had repressed memory, there was a sample, I believe it was something like 19% of people that had repressed memory, even in Elizabeth Loftus's study. So I think that it's harder and harder, and as the research accumulates, to deny the existence of dissociation.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Gail, for joining us. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Well, thank you, Wayne.
That was an interview with Gail Fisher Taylor, sharing her views and insights into the effects of trauma, ritual abuse, and mind control. Gail is a psychotherapist working in Toronto with trauma survivors. Next, we're going to hear an interview with Dr. Connie Christensen, professor of psychology at Carleton University in Ottawa. Dr. Christensen specializes in recovered memory research and sexual abuse issues. I'm talking with Dr. Connie Christensen, who is a professor at Carleton University, and I guess I'd like to begin about asking you what is your background and what things you are working on with regards to child abuse.
I'm trained as a social psychologist, and I've been applying this background to, first of all, understand the social psychological factors underlying people's opinions in the recovered memory debate. And then I've also been examining the nature of women's recovered memories of child abuse and contrasting those memories, for example, with the characteristics of the memories of women who never forgot about their abuse. So I've done some research with adult women who have, in fact, survived child sexual abuse. So generally, I've been doing social psychological analyses of the recovered memory debate and trying to gain more insight into the nature of recovered memories.
I understand you were attending the Making Up for Lost Time conference in Thunder Bay. This was back in 94, I guess. What did you come away with that might have been new information to you, or what were you? Were there any expectations going in into the conference? Or?
I guess the one thing that I came away with was a greater appreciation for people's concern with ritual abuse and the mind control experiments that have been done, And in my mind, from my perspective, I have difficulty believing some of the stories that are that I heard. So I'm a little bit skeptical. However, on the other hand, I know that people don't believe all sorts of things that can indeed be true. So I'm trying to stay open-minded in regard to the more extreme forms of abuse that people are speaking about.
With your experiences, how prevalent do you think child abuse is in our society? Maybe you could talk about how many from people that have been abused as children, how many do suffer memory repression or memory loss or dissociation?
My understanding or my estimate that I would make of the incidence of child abuse would be about 1 in 3 women being sexually abused prior to age 18, and maybe 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 men. And I'm basing these estimates on the findings of a couple of large epidemiological studies done both in Canada and in the States. My review of the literature to date, as well as the findings from the Ottawa Survivor Study that we conducted here out of Carleton, indicate that roughly between 40% and 60% of all women who are sexually abused will report at least some memory loss for the child abuse events. So in the Ottawa Survivor Study, for example, about 50% of the sample of 113 women said that they had at least some memory loss.
And can you talk about like how that mechanism, for lack of a better term, works with somebody that has undergone some kind of trauma and experienced some kind of memory loss? Like, what is going on in the human brain and body?
There have been a couple of processes that have been talked about to account for this memory loss. One is repression, which I think is what most people think of. And the evidence for repression, whereby a person sort of unconsciously, unknowingly keeps a lid on something traumatic that they don't want to know about, the evidence for that kind of unconscious process in repression is actually quite weak. But there is strong evidence that people will actively try to suppress information. And in fact, Freud himself sometimes spoke of repression as an active rather than an unconscious process. So if you look at repression as an active phenomenon whereby a person tries to forget a traumatic event and also manages to forget trying to forget, then there is some evidence for repression. But probably what most researchers are looking at to explain the memory loss of child sexual abuse is the notion of dissociation. And dissociation is a type of altered state of consciousness that occurs as a result of trauma. And what happens during trauma is that there are various neurochemical changes that occur in the form of what you might call it a traumatic stress response. And these neurochemical changes are known to change and adversely affect our conscious memory processes. It changes the neurochemicals that have been found to be associated with conscious memory processes. These neurochemicals also affect various brain structures physically that are responsible for conscious memory processes. So ultimately what seems to happen is that during trauma, the neurochemicals overwhelm our normal memory system, and as a result, people cannot remember traumatic abuse in the way we normally remember daily events. Rather, what does get stored at the time of trauma is a non-conscious type of memory, which operates in a different part of the brain, which isn't made dysfunctional by the trauma. So the memories are laid down in this alternative memory system, and the memories there are raw perceptual, sensory, bodily sensations and emotions. They're not your sort of conscious memories where I went to the store and then I did this and then I did that. You might remember, for example, if when you went to the store, you might remember the fumes of a diesel bus that had just gone by, but you would remember those fumes out of context and with no sort of cognitive framework to embed it in. And so that's how we think that memory is laid down at the time of trauma, is in this bodily and sensory form. And that's actually what we see survivors telling us when they recover their memories. They don't come back the normal way that we talk about memory. What they'll do is they'll come sort of willy-nilly out of the blue, and the person will feel like they're literally reliving some part of that event. So they may have a smell, an image, a sensation, or an emotional experience that comes back, and it doesn't make sense in the current day context. But what it is these fragments of sensory and emotional memory that are sort of flashing back into the present.
Now, of course, the debate around recovered memory is being hotly debated in North America. And there are some groups out there that have been very active in pursuing lawsuits against therapists and survivors that are coming forward. I'm thinking particularly of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. What has your experiences been with that group?
I know that some of my academic colleagues who would advocate in favor of the idea of false memory syndrome have tried to bring me up on ethical charges. And I hear that's something common by FMS advocates trying to get the researchers on ethics. So far, they haven't been successful. And other experiences that I've had with them, well, they'll write to me sometimes. And always little bits of information, sarcastic humor, nothing too nasty.
Are you aware of other therapists being intimidated by this group? Or?
Oh, well, if you take Laura Brown, who's an active psychologist who worked on the review of the recovered memory issue with the American Psychological Association. Laura Brown's office has been picketed on a regular basis, and she's perpetually harassed. So I know there's a lot of harassment going on out there, especially in the States. Here in Canada, I think we're a little more mellow.
Mm-hmm.
Give us 10 years, maybe we'll be on par.
How do you think this environment has changed the resources available for people that may suspect they have been victims of child abuse?
I gather that it hasn't been beneficial. Well, it's sort of it's a knife that cuts both ways, actually. In one sense, the publicity given to child abuse has made a lot of therapists and people who acknowledge the validity of the research findings on which the information is based, people who are learning about child abuse are now taking it more seriously. So maybe there's better treatment, better resources to some extent. One good consequence of the recovered memory controversy is that I think more money is being funded into research for both sides of the camp, those who support recovered memories and those who believe they're false. So, of course, we're going to learn more about traumatic memory one way or another, and that can't be bad. And ultimately, hopefully, it would help survivors. On the other hand, I think that it's had a really bad impact on survivors in several ways. One is you hear things about the Criminal Compensation Board being suspect of any claims based on recovered memories. So survivors are having a rougher time getting some financial compensation based on this debate, because of this debate. Other consequences, well, in the Ottawa Survivor Study, we also assessed how the debate was affecting these women. And not surprisingly, these women said that this debate was having an adverse effect on all the areas of their lives that had been previously affected by the trauma. So in other words, this debate is re-victimizing some of the survivors and making them experience more of those symptoms again. So it's having a detrimental effect. On the other hand, a small minority of this sample said it's made them mad as hell and they're getting out there to do something about it. So I can see that it's activated some women in a really positive way.
And what you mentioned the FMSF using other people to attack therapists on grounds of ethics. What other kind of arguments are they using? And are there indeed other organizations like FMSF that exist out there that have been actively kind of intimidating people?
I don't know about any other organizations, but what they're saying is that some therapists are doing what they call voodoo therapy. In fact, the FMSers have called me a voodoo scientist. And so what they're claiming is that some therapist techniques are actually causing the creation of false memories. In the cases where they are picketing and so on, I'm pretty convinced that this isn't going on. A lot of psychologists know what they're doing. They're doing good work with their clients. They're not suggesting things to their clients. And I think some of the better work is probably being done by the feminists because they have a sort of non-authoritarian style. So they're not inclined to tell clients what they think happened or what caused their state of beingness at this point, whereas more traditional psychiatric approaches tend to have an idea of what the person is like before they've even met the person.
More judgmental,
and they impose, the clinician imposes their own reality on the client. So I think the feminists have a good approach in terms of working with recovered memory, simply because they try to empower the client to take better care of themselves rather than the therapist looking after the client and telling her what her reality is.
What kind of approaches do therapists take with clients in order to avoid being accused of implanting memories? And has this changed because of the rise of the FMSF?
Well, I know some therapists who've actually refused to take on clients who might take their alleged perpetrators to court on the basis of recovered memories. I know there are other therapists who've stopped treating survivors altogether. Then there are other therapists who are, you know, being especially careful to monitor their behavior, to make sure they're not suggestive, particularly when any abuse stuff comes up. So people are using different approaches, I think, depending on how confident they feel in themselves. And I don't mean in terms of their own ability, but how they could deal with a potential lawsuit and whether they really want to face that possibility.
So do people kind of have ways of documenting, like taping the sessions or things like that?
Yeah, I think a lot of therapists are learning now that if they're going to use techniques like hypnosis, they should ideally have an audiovisual tape of the session, because in that way there's clear evidence exactly how suggestive was the process. And so that's highly recommended, is to tape everything when it comes to be about sort of abuse issues.
Now, some of the arguments in this debate are, like children just making up stories just to get back at their parents for some, whatever reason. How difficult is it, do you think, to tell whether somebody is actually, just making up a story, or that there is real signs of abuse there?
I imagine it would probably be pretty difficult. Well, one of the things that we did in the Ottawa Survivor Study was look to see if we could identify anybody who has this nosologically unrecognized entity called false memory syndrome. And so what we did was we developed a list of the symptoms of false memory syndrome based on the writings of the FMS Foundation and their advisory board members. And we went out and documented how many women with recovered memory satisfied these criteria. And the rate was very, very low. Like a few percent of the women with recovered memories could potentially be classified as having false memory syndrome. The rate was just as high, though, with the women who had never forgotten their abuse and who had continuous memories. So those criteria don't seem to differentiate continuous from recovered memories. And moreover, some of the criteria are just downright silly. One of them is that you should suspect a claim of abuse if it is denied by the alleged perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would expect that many perpetrators would deny abuse that had actually occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not surprised that the criteria didn't differentiate. Another criteria is that their children were blissfully happy as young children and teenagers, and they were doing very well in life until they met the therapist who implanted the memory. Well, when we looked at the data, we found that the women with recovered memories reported as much symptomology in childhood and in their teen years as the women with continuous memories reported. So their symptom levels are basically the same, which goes contrary to what the FMS Foundation is claiming.
Well, thank you very much, Connie, for joining us on CKLN. I wish you all the best in your work.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Connie Christensen, professor of psychology at Carleton University, and previous to that, an interview with Gail Fisher-Taylor. That concludes the interviews for this radio series. We're going to wrap it all up with two panel discussions the next 2 weeks. First, a panel on ritual abuse and survivor healing with Toronto-based therapists Elise Murphy and Gail Fisher-Taylor, and survivor and advocate Karen Stardancer, publisher of Survivorship. Then on Sunday, March the 1st, a panel discussion on mind control, government military mind control, with Walter Boert, author of Operation Mind Control, and Don Gilmore, author of I Swear by Apollo. So have your questions ready, because we'll be opening the phone lines so you can voice your concerns with these issues the next 2 weeks. Tapes and transcripts of this entire radio series are available at the office of CKLN at 380 Victoria, Jorgensen Hall at Ryerson University. You've been listening to 88.1. And coming up next is A Key in Western America.
For Andy, he is I, and I working so hard. And he